Here it says that Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus said to him, "It is as you say." Now we'll just stop there because we're introduced straight away to a new character in this whole saga, and that would be the governor. We know that this governor's name is Pontius Pilate. Verse 13 addresses him specifically by name, and he is central to today's text. Now, who is this governor? Before we get too far into this, I want to give you guys a bit of a glimpse into who this man was so that we understand that as we move forward, because I think it's important to do so as we look at this individual. This governor, Pontius Pilate, had a nice house on the Mediterranean coast, but at this point in his office, he would have been stationed in Jerusalem. Okay, so he's out of town. On site at Jerusalem during the Passover, it was common for them to have additional officers in town during important Jewish gatherings like this, where there was lots and lots and lots of people coming from all directions, in order to prevent uprisings. So at the time of the Passover, there would have been more officials, more authority, there would have been more officers, more soldiers, and all to kind of try and keep order in the community there. Now, if you read the Gospels, if you're familiar with what Matthew, Mark, and Luke have to say about this man, you know that it seems as if they're presenting him as a kind of a passive man, or, sure he was a Roman, but he seems rather considerate to the Jewish people, eager to please them, as it seems when we read the text. But really, there was nothing of the sort. There was between Pontius Pilate and others, but particularly the governor here in view, there was a mutual hatred between the governor and the Roman people. Between the governor and the Jewish people. Pilate was Roman to the core. He was a nationalist. He was a very much a patriot to his own country and countrymen. And so he didn't like the Jews for multiple reasons, but he was known for being a man who would massacre them at the slightest hint of rebellion. Any excuse to exterminate some Jews was a good one for him. He was anti-Semitic is the term that we oftentimes use, but he was a terrorist, really, who would send his men into the crowds during great festivals and feasts like this just to kill people who were obnoxious to him. So if he didn't like you, he'd send somebody in the crowd to knife you. First century Jewish philosopher, a man named Philo, he recorded a letter that had been circulated among the Roman leaders, speaking of Pilate particularly, describing him as, quote, an unbending and recklessly hard individual. The letter says that he was a man of notorious reputation, severe brutality, prejudice, savage violence, and murder. That's Pilate. So this is the governor that we're looking at here today. Elsewhere, he's described as a wolf, thirsty for Jewish blood. So he's just an opponent and an enemy of the Jewish people. So don't let what the Gospels seem to present him as fool you into believing that he was a decent guy. This was a man whose life was rife with sin. And now his reckless behavior had caught up with him. See, because you live a life of sin, you live a life of lawlessness and disobedience to your Creator, it's eventually going to catch up to you, which it did to him. And so as a result, his office was under investigation by Rome. So he had already started to increase the suspicions of his own authorities, and so they sent surveillance. He was being watched. And so you need to know that moving forward in the narrative today, because that plays into all of this. That's why, if anything, he's portrayed as kind of passive and compliant with the Jews. He's trying to suck up. He's trying to not get in trouble. So he's walking on eggshells, is what we might say. Last thing that he wants is to make trouble with his name attached to it. Because if there's any uprising, if there's any disturbance of the peace, if there's any controversy that happens under his watch at this festival, at this time, he's going to be reported back to his authorities. It's going to make its way all the way back up to the emperor, and he's going to lose his job, if not worse. So he's walking carefully here. That would explain the apparent change in his character, right? The freedom, I'll tell you on a personal note, that sin promises you was the same sin that he was tempted by, and it promised the same freedoms that it promised Pilate. So he took the bait and walked in sin for many, many years, and I say now it's catching up to him, and I'll tell you personally that the freedom sin promises you always turns into bondage eventually. Always. Always. See, sin promises freedom. Live as you want, do as you please. Pilate did that. If he didn't like you, he'd shank you or send somebody else to do his dirty work. He was a terrorist. He had hitmen. He lived however he wanted. No authority. He was top dog. He didn't like you. Too bad. And now he's on the receiving end. So Pilate is no exception to the rule, the universal law that says sin is only sweet for a season. Sin is only sweet for a little while. I love the fact that the Bible is honest enough to acknowledge the fact that sin is sweet, because we would all concur. Sin is awesome. You ever heard a pastor say that? Love it. Love it. We all do. That's why we indulge. That's why we sin. And you and I both know as well as Scripture does that it's only good for a while. Sin is only sweet for a season. And in Duluth, we all know how seasons work. As soon as one arrives, it changes, right? Sweet for a season, except for winter. That's sour the whole way through. But summer is sweet, but it eventually gets cold again. And such is the case. Such is the case with sin. You can only enjoy it for a little while until your season of choice changes on you. So here comes Pilate. And now Jesus is on trial. You remember now that he's facing a number of civil trials. The religious trials are over. The Jews found him guilty of blasphemy, but now they got to convince the Roman authorities that he's guilty of some infraction of their own laws so that they can get him killed, executed, because they couldn't do it themselves. They were under Roman occupation. The Jews couldn't kill people like they used to, and so now they got to get the Romans to somehow do it. So they bring Jesus before the governor, who's in charge, has the authority to put Jesus to death or to let him live. And so they know where to go. And so they go to Pilate, and they're trying to get Pilate to do their dirty work. And Pilate now asks him, "Are you the king of the Jews? Are you the king of the Jews? Is it true what they're saying about you, that you're the king of the Jews?" So that was one of the accusations that the Jewish leaders had made against Jesus, to try and get him in hot water with the Roman authorities. Because if Jesus goes around saying that he's a king, he poses a threat to the emperor. He poses a threat to the Caesar. And so they're thinking, this is a really good plan. If we tell Pilate that he's been going around professing to be the king of the Jews, then that will hopefully be enough to count as treason, which no doubt they'll execute him for. And so that was one of the accusations they made against Jesus. But the high priests had presented Pilate with several charges against Jesus, all of which would have been of keen interest to the Roman government. There were several. This is just one of them. One of them would have been refusing to pay taxes. Okay, the Romans would have been really interested in that one. Really? He doesn't pay taxes? And he teaches others to not pay their taxes? This is trouble. We need to off him. Okay, so that was one of the charges they brought. Another one was planning a revolt, he's an insurrectionist. He's gonna try and overtake you. He's gonna, political muscle and then the third one was claiming to be a king. Now the first two, the taxes bit and planning a revolt, those held no water. They weren't true. Jesus did pay taxes. Jesus did pay taxes, and he taught his followers to pay taxes. We have record of that in Matthew chapter 17. Okay. So if you're a Christian out there that just thinks that you can kind of sidestep the tax issue, just in case. I don't know if you're one of them. That doesn't fly. Jesus taught his people to pay taxes. Jesus himself paid taxes. The second one, as far as leading a revolt, Jesus never led a revolt. If anything, he stopped revolts from happening. He stopped his people from revolting. You remember one of them drew a sword and tried to cut off heads, right? And Jesus goes, "Put your sword away." He stopped it from happening. So those two things are just outrageous. But king? Being a king? That he couldn't deny. Because he is. He's not an insurrectionist. He's not a tax dodger. But he is a king. King of the Jews, indeed. In fact, not only was it true that Jesus was king of the Jews, Jesus was also king of the Germans, the Italians, the Koreans. Jesus was, he's king of the Koreans, north and south. He's king of the Japanese. Where are you? He's king of the world. He's king of the universe. And moreover, not only is he king of the world, he's the creator of it. But he wasn't asked that. He was simply asked, are you the king of the Jews? So he says, yes. Little did Pilate know, not only was he speaking face-to-face with the king of the Jews, he was speaking face-to-face with the creator of the universe. Now, it's going to go on here, and in verse 14, tell us that Pilate marveled greatly. I'll tell you that Pilate would have marveled even more greatly if he would have found out who he was actually talking to. King of the Jews, yes, it's true, but that's nothing compared to the truth of who Christ is. Had Pilate understood who Jesus really was, get this, he wouldn't have killed him. He wouldn't have killed him. Like, if you kill the one who created the universe and sustains it, what happens to the universe? Have you ever thought of that? Okay, Jesus created the world. That includes people. That includes me. He holds the molecules of my body together. If I kill him, do I explode or implode or cease to exist? Do I melt? Do I vanish? Vapor? What happens? I better not do it. I better not kill the creator for fear of what will happen to the creation. Okay. King of the Jews? Yes. King of the world? If Pilate would have known that Jesus was the king not only of the Jews but of the Romans as well, he would have second-guessed his decision to put him to death. So he wouldn't have done it. 1 Corinthians 2:8 confirms and says, quote, the rulers of this world, that includes Pilate, didn't understand the mystery. If they had, they would not have crucified Jesus. That's 1 Corinthians 2:8. They wouldn't have done it. So Pilate is clueless. He doesn't know who he's talking to, but he's getting glimpses. Are you the king of the Jews? Yes, I am. Okay, you know more about this carpenter than you did before. You know that he's more important than just making benches and tables and whatever the carpenters did back then. This man is a king, not a carpenter. He's a king. So that alone should have made Pilate second guess his decision to move along with the trial. But it didn't. It didn't. Verse 12. While Jesus was being accused by the chief priests and elders, he answered nothing. So then Pilate says to him, do you not hear how many things they testify against you? Like, you moron. Charge after charge after charge, they're hollering everything, and you're just going to stand there like an idiot and say nothing? Jesus answered him not one word in verse 14, and that's what made the governor marvel greatly. This is probably the first and only time in Pilate's 10-year career as governor of Judea that he ever saw a defendant not beg for his life. Pilate had a 10-year career as governor. He probably stood on the judgment bench and, you know, sat on the judgment throne time and time again. He executed, you know, like he crucified lots and lots of people. This was just kind of par for the course. Just another morning. Who's on the docket? Bring them up. What are the charges? Kill him. He was obnoxious to me anyway. And then here's this one. Are you king of the Jews? And they're just hurling insults and accusations, and Jesus is just standing there. And Pilate's like, what are you going to do? What are you going to say to that? Aren't you going to defend yourself? And Pilate's mind is blown. Marveled greatly, that's what it means. In the original English, it means, what? Pilate is dumbfounded. He's shocked. Most prisoners, you and I both know, would naturally, in a situation like this, be pleading their case. Wouldn't they? Defending their innocence, even if they're not innocent. That's what usually happens. All right, they might just step up and either try to confess their way out of it or lie their way out of it, but either way, they're going to be quite verbal in a situation like this to try and get themselves out of execution. And yet, here's Jesus, silent, just stood there and let them make all the accusations they wanted, make any and every claim against him without defending himself, in spite of the fact that his silence implied guilt, right? By being quiet, that almost is going to make him look even more guilty. Come on. All of these charges, and you're not going to say anything? It's probably because they're true. And so Jesus knows that it makes him look more guilty, but he embraced every false charge that fell upon him. And here's why. Because to clear himself of the accusations brought against him, which he easily could have done and probably was tempted to do, but to clear himself of the accusations brought against him would have left, quote, the load of guilt upon those whose place he came to take. Because if he's not guilty, then who is? All of them. All of the people, all of the elders, all of the high priests, Caiaphas, Pilate, all of the people Jesus came to die for. So if he offloads the guilt, as he easily could have done and probably was tempted to do, if he would have defended himself, the guilt would have shifted from him to them. And by implication, us. All of us. So why did Jesus remain silent? Because he loves you. And because he loves you. And you. And you. That's why he stayed quiet. He took your guilt. He took your guilt. He took Pilate's guilt, if Pilate will accept it. He took Caiaphas. He took everybody's guilt. Judas's, if he hasn't yet. He takes her guilt. That's what he does. So he just stands there. They sinned, and Jesus quietly took the blame for their sin. And he still does that same thing today, guys. Okay? So you can put any sin on Jesus that you want. He invites you to do so. You can accuse him of the very things that you are guilty of. Huh? Have you come into church this morning guilty of drunkenness? Guilty of drunkenness. Accuse Jesus of that. Throw it on him. You drunkard! He's a drunkard! Go ahead. You can. Are you guilty of fornication? You know what fornication is? That's premarital sex. Oops. Am I not supposed to talk about that? How many of us aren't guilty? Throw it on Jesus. He's a fornicator! He's a fornicator! He's a blasphemer! He's an adulterer! He's a drunkard, he's a liar, he's a cheat. Whatever you've done, you can throw it on Jesus and he'll stand there silently and let you do it. He won't say a thing. He'll absorb your guilt, gladly accepting the responsibility for it because that's what he came to do. So you and me are the ones this morning in the crowd hurling all the false accusations against him that are probably true of us. And he's silent. He's not going to defend himself. Because that would be to shift the guilt to you, where it belongs, where it would rightly be, but no, he came to take the blame. Do you understand that? Jesus died for your guilt and mine. And so Jesus is quiet and Pilate is shocked. That's how this is unfolding for us this morning. Pilate doesn't know what to do about Jesus. He's just, you can imagine him kind of wringing his fingers and going, oh man, you know, what do I do? He's never been in a situation like this, and he doesn't want the responsibility of it. Because you remember, he's under surveillance. If anything goes wrong during the festival, if anybody gets too worked up, if there's a riot, and now what's happening? A riot! So he wants to try and offload the responsibility onto somebody else. In the Gospel of Luke, Luke tells us that at this point, Pilate actually sent Jesus to Herod, King Herod. he found out that Jesus was from Galilee, and he's like, hey, that's out of my jurisdiction. You need to go to Herod. Woo! Done with that. And so he sends Jesus to Herod, and guess what happens there? Jesus won't say nothing. He's quiet there too. So Herod's like, get him out of here. And Pilate's like, no. Right? You're supposed to do something. But he won't. So then he comes back to Pilate. And so that's how the narrative unfolds. Pilate is a man, doesn't want to have to make a decision. He's kind of nervous for how this is going to unfold, and he doesn't want the responsibility. So he comes up with this brilliant plan in verse 15, because it says, at the feast, the governor was accustomed to releasing to the multitude one prisoner whom they wished. And so now he's remembering this custom that they have, and he's like, aha, here's my ticket out. Didn't work sending Jesus to Herod. He's back in my lap, but there's this thing where at every Passover, I get to release a prisoner, no questions asked. Well, at that time in verse 16, it says that they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas or Baraba. And therefore, when they had gathered together, Pilate asked everybody and he said, well, who do you want me to release to you, Baraba or Jesus, who is called Christ? And the reason that he says, because he knew they handed Jesus over because of envy. He knew this was a sham trial. He knew this was just absolutely out of line. And so he's looking for a way out, well aware of the fact that the Jews are using him to do their dirty work. And so he takes advantage of this certain tradition that had been established, whereby they would just release a prisoner of the people's choosing. Again, no questions asked. And so he brings up another individual, somebody, a notorious prisoner named Baraba. Matthew says, this is a notorious prisoner for a reason. Matthew says that Baraba was notorious. John tells us in his gospel that this man was arrested for armed robbery. He was a robber. Luke tells us that he was convicted of murder. And Mark tells us that this man wasn't working alone. And so he was a ringleader of a sort of a mob of sorts, a mafia, where they would kill people in order to get their own work done. So very dangerous, very evil, very influential man, and very much a threat to society. And no clear-thinking individual would want a guy like this on the loose. He just kills people. Armed robbery. He's dangerous. He's got a rap sheet that's a mile long. You don't want a guy like this turned loose. And Pilate knows that. So he's like, I'm going to find the most notorious prisoner I can, and I'll offer that guy. Nobody wants him to be released. And so I'm going to go, do you want the really bad guy that's a threat to society to just be roaming among you? Or do you want Jesus, who like healed a bunch of people and fed people for free and educated everybody? Which one? He knows, at least he thinks he knows, that they're going to choose Jesus. Let Jesus go. Jesus isn't that bad of a guy. Baraba? Good grief, he killed my cousin, right? Execute that man. So his intent was to find the worst criminal in the entire penitentiary and then let the people choose between him and Jesus, with the assumption that the majority of the people would rather execute Baraba and release Jesus. I think that's a very clever plan. To his chagrin, it's not going to work. But I want you to remember that it was only days ago that the crowds were cheering for Jesus as he rode into Jerusalem. You remember that? I mean, they were just happy about Jesus. It was the leaders that wanted Jesus dead. Verse 18 tells us that. And so Pilate figures that, well, they're going to let Jesus go. He was well aware of the fact that the crowds favored Jesus. Okay? Remember that. Pilate was well aware of the fact that the majority of the Jews favored Jesus, which at this point, they actually did. And I'll explain how that shifts so dramatically in a moment. But before I get there, the man's name is Baraba. Now, it's B-A-R, is oftentimes placed in front of a Jewish name to indicate who the father of that individual was. So if you ever remember Jesus calling Peter Simon Barjona, Simon Barjona. Bar means son of. Jonah would have been his dad. Simon Bar-Jonah means Simon, son of Jonah. And so there's a few times in Scripture where there's a hyphenated bar and then this. So Bar-Abba, bar means son of. Do you know what Abba means? Abba. It's a verse. We say it. The Bible says you say it. Abba, Father.
Abba, Father. Abba means father, like father, daddy.
And so who is this? Son of Baraba, son of the father. This is son of the father. And what's even more interesting is that in the original texts, they provide not only his surname, Baraba, but they actually include his first name. So if you look at the original language, we find out that his surname is Baraba, but it doesn't include it here in the New King James. But it includes his official name, which, guess what? His name was Jesus. Jesus Baraba. Jesus, son of the father. And so when Pilate asks them in verse 17, who do you want? He's offering them two different Jesuses. Do you want Jesus, son of the father? Or do you want Jesus, the one who's called Christ? Which Jesus do you want? You get to pick. Everybody gets to pick the one that they prefer. And you know what? It's all going to come down to democratic election. They all get to cast their vote. You either want this one or you want that one. And let me ask you this morning, which kind of Jesus have you picked for yourself? Because there are more than one for you to select. And there's only one that's true and right, but there are many others. Who have you decided your Jesus is going to be? What's he like? And if you explained him to me, would your definition match the scriptural identity that we find of the true and living Lord? Lots of people have lots of belief in Jesus, and there's lots of Jesuses to choose from, but I'm telling you that there is only one. Apparently, though, as we see here, you can have a politically charged Jesus who approves of all kinds of revolt, one who lives by the sword and answers to no one, not man, not God, not government. He just kind of is a self-made individual, and, well, we like Jesuses like that, ones that don't answer to anybody and just kind of forge their own way. We like Baraba. We like Jesus Baraba. A Jesus who promises freedom? Freedom! But eventually leads his followers into bondage? Like Jesus Baraba. Remember, he wasn't working alone. He's chained with a couple of others. We'll find out later. You want a Jesus who won't hesitate to steal, kill, and destroy in order to get done what he wants to get done? There are some Jesuses who do that, but last time I checked in my Bible, the devil is the one who came to steal, kill, and destroy. But hey, there's more than one Jesus, and you get to pick. So do you want Jesus Baraba? Or do you want Jesus who is the Christ? A Jesus who refuses to entangle himself in worldly affairs like politics. A Jesus who submits himself not only to God, but yes, to man and to government, as we see plainly here. Do you want to follow a Jesus who provides freedom to those who follow through the practice of volunteer slavery? Do you want a Jesus who allowed himself to be killed in order to accomplish what he came to do? Do you want a Jesus that appears to be rather passive, rather helpless? Do you want that Jesus who is called Christ? Or do you want a worldly Jesus, Baraba? See, we get to pick. And unfortunately, people are just picking what they sort of want according to their own sinful desires. And that's what's going to happen here. It won't be but just a few more moments, and they'll all be shouting that, we want Baraba, crucify Jesus. So anyway, I ask you this morning, which Jesus do you want? If you were in their shoes, whose presence and whose spirit would you most want to preserve in your life and your community? A hostile, violent, savage, murdering thief? Is that the spirit that you want to pervade your life? Or do you want one of humility and love and peace and joy? Which Jesus gets your vote? Which Jesus gets your allegiance? Which Jesus do you most admire? And that is a critical decision. It's a critical decision. And you think it'd be easy, don't you? I mean, come on. We all know the answer to it, don't we? I know which Jesus we should pick. It's the nice one. It's the meek and mild one. It's the one who died on a cross. That's the Jesus we should pick. That's not what I'm asking this morning. I'm not asking which Jesus you should pick. I'm asking which Jesus you did pick. Which Jesus have you chosen? Pilate is about to discover for himself that this is not an easy decision. He's about to discover for himself just how common it is for people to pick the wrong Jesus. So with all the confidence that a man could ever have, he asks them again, which one do you want? Assuming they're going to choose to release Jesus and crucify Barabbas. So he asks, who do you want me to release? Look at in verse 19. He was asking again, but while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent to him, saying, have nothing to do with that just man. I've suffered many things today in a dream because of him. Now, what's this? Matthew's the only one that records this interruption. But it's interesting that there's an interruption. Now, you remember how I said it's at this point that all of the crowds, the majority of the Jews, loved Jesus. Okay? You remember only days ago they were just, Hosanna, son of David, right? They love this guy. Jesus is awesome, and they know it. But now, just as Pilate asks the question, which one do you want me to release? Suddenly now, he's interrupted. Just as it says in verse 19, he's taken his place in the judgment seat. So he's on the verge of making the decision final to release Jesus, presumably, and wash his hands of all responsibility. But then he suddenly, unexpectedly, gets a message from his wife. She's off stage somewhere, but she sends a message and it reaches him. And I believe that the message itself would have been incredibly startling for him to hear this. The timing of it wasn't coincidental. I mean, he's just about to, and then his wife sends a message and goes, you better leave that guy alone. You cannot crucify Jesus. He's innocent. He's just. And when you consider the timing of it, I think that this would have sent shockwaves through the mind and conscience of Pontius Pilate. This would have been like being on the verge of committing adultery against your spouse, only to get a text from your spouse saying, I love you. You're crawling into bed with somebody else, and your phone goes off, and it's them. Now, for you to go through with the act anyway, imagine what that would do to your conscience. Imagine the fight you'd have to put up against what you now know and have just, like a flood, recalled that you are about to commit a great act of sin against somebody who loves you that deeply. And that's exactly where Pilate is at right here. And he's going to forge ahead anyway. Ignore his wife. Ignore the counsel that came through the Lord. Because, guys, this dream had been given by God. Make no mistake. This wasn't just like, I had a funny dream. God met her in her dream. And the reason is not why we might think. Okay? God sent that dream to this woman, but it wasn't so that Pilate would put the brakes on the trial and dismiss the case and release Jesus. Okay, that wasn't the reason why God sent the dream. And I know that God didn't want to put the brakes on the case and have Pilate release Jesus because, listen to me, God wanted to see Jesus on a cross as much as Caiaphas did. God wanted to see Jesus Christ on a cross as much as any of the God-hating Jewish religious leaders did. So what was the reason for the dream then? If God wasn't trying to, through his wife, get Pilate to, like, release innocent Jesus, then what was God trying to do with the dream? You want to know what that was? The reason God had that dream come to her was to suspend the proceedings just long enough to give the priests in the crowd the time they needed to sway the opinion of the masses. And that's exactly what they're going to do. While Pilate is distracted with this message coming out of nowhere from his wife, the priests and the elders are going to get to work right quick and mingle through the crowds and get everybody stirred up against Jesus. So you remember just before that text message came, they all loved Jesus. In only a matter of moments, they're going to be persuaded that he's a bad guy. Look at verse 20. The chief priests and elders persuaded the multitudes that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. So that's what's going on while he's reviewing the texts. While he's kind of trying to filter through the message and figure this all out. I don't know how long it took, but that's what they're doing. So it was just prior to this, the multitudes really liked Jesus. If the decision to release Jesus or Barabbas came down to a vote, there was no way the priests would win. And so they're getting to work trying to convince the people to shift their vote. I don't know how long it took for verse 19 to run its course, but apparently it was enough time for the Jewish leaders to turn the hearts of the people against Jesus. What they said or how they did it, I don't know. But they were successful in their attempt. Their campaign was a win. They swayed the hearts of the multitudes against Christ. That not only speaks to the assertiveness of their effort, they were aggressive. They were working quick. And they were exerting all the pressure that they could muster as authority figures in the community. So it speaks not only to their assertiveness, but the fact that they were able to sway so many people so quickly speaks also to the shallowness of the devotion in the average follower of Christ, at least in the first century. Not so sure about the 21st century, but I have to wonder if there aren't similarities. Perhaps we're just as shallow. Maybe it's true that your heart is swayed away from Jesus in a moment's notice. It all depends on how your day looks, what opportunities you're given, what temptations you face. Maybe your allegiance is still with Jesus right now, but maybe, given the right circumstances, you'd flip on him just like they did. I don't know. All I do know is that they're extremely shallow in their devotion to Christ. Hardly took anything to pull them away from Jesus. Happened in minutes. But now Pilate comes back from the distraction. He wants to find out, are you going to choose Jesus? Are you going to choose Barabbas? And so, perhaps unbeknownst to the fact that they had been working in the crowds, he resumes the interrogation and asks the question once again in verse 21. He answered and said to them, which of the two do you want me to return to you? And they said, Barabbas. What? That is not what he expected. Barabbas? Look at it. Pilate said to them, what then shall I do with Jesus who's called Christ? And they all said to him, let him be crucified. Let him be crucified. Not Barabbas. Release Barabbas. Let Jesus be crucified. Pilate is stunned. Just opposite of what he expected. Once again, his plan is foiled. I mean, he's been trying to dump him off on Herod, and he's just trying to like, who do you want? Maybe we could let you. And he's just failing and failing and failing. And what he's doing, he didn't realize it, but he's painting himself into a corner. He's trying to avoid a decision that he's going to be forced to make. So many people like him don't want to make the decision on Christ. I'll try and play the middle ground. People do what Pilate's doing here all their life. Play the middle ground. I don't want to outright say I hate Jesus Christ, but I don't want to like give my life to him either. So I'm going to try and dance and duck and dodge and weave all my pathetic life like Pilate did, vacillate between like a pretty decent guy and an absolute brute so that nobody really knows what to make of me. Just kind of like a double-minded individual, just living two lives, secret here, public here. And what God's doing is he's keeping enough paint in your bucket for you to successfully paint yourself into that corner you're headed for. He'll do that. But eventually, just like it did for Pilate, it will catch up to you and you will be forced to decide. Pilate now is in the hot seat. You would think he was being on the judgment throne that he held the authority. Nope, God does. And when God wants you to choose, he's going to force you to do that. So here's these people now going, well, crucify him. Let him be crucified. Who are these people? We need to answer that before we go any further. Okay, who's in the crowd? Who are these multitudes of people? Because that's the word that's being used to describe them. And I'll tell you that the word for multitudes that we read in verse 20 is the same word used to describe the people who got baptized by John in the Jordan River in Luke chapter 3. Same word. The word that's used to describe this crowd is the same word that's used to describe the people that Jesus fed with fish and bread in John chapter 6. It's also the same word that's used of the great crowds that Jesus had graciously taught all things in Mark chapter 2. And it's the same word that's used to describe all of the sick and diseased people that he healed in Luke chapter 6. It's also the same word that's used to identify the masses who followed him into Jerusalem earlier that week, who spread their coats on the road and called him the Son of David in Matthew chapter 21. So who are these people? Not sure, but it ain't looking good. Only days ago they were shouting, "Hosanna! Hosanna!" And now it's, "Crucify him! Just kill him!" That's amazing. That's amazing that people can shift so dramatically. This isn't just a change of opinion. This is polar opposite from who these people were only moments ago. And Pilate recognizes that something is wrong and things aren't going according to his own plan. And he says, "Why? Crucify him? Why? What evil has he done?" They don't have an answer. What evil has he done? Well, he hasn't. But they're not going to answer that question. They just shout and cry all the more, saying, "Let him be crucified." They're just insistent upon it. What evil has he done? See, Pilate can clearly see that Jesus is innocent. What evil has he done? Pilate, the Roman governor, who finds Jewish people so obnoxious that he has them executed just for fun. This is a guy who, at the slightest hint of rebellion, would just massacre people. And now he's looking at this Jew that all the Jews want dead, and he's defending a Jew. He's like, "What did he do? What did he do?" He can clearly see that Jesus is innocent. Now, if you haven't noticed, Matthew, the author of this gospel, has kind of been stringing together for us an airtight case for Jesus' innocence. And he's been doing so on the most unlikely testimonies of witnesses that you never would have expected. First, Judas. Judas, if you remember, Matthew records it, Judas testified of Christ's innocence. You remember, he came into the priests after he had betrayed. He comes and he says, "Jesus is innocent. I've betrayed innocent blood. This was me. He didn't do anything wrong." So we have Judas's confession in verse 4 of this chapter. Then after that, it's the chief priests. The chief priests themselves who admit that the 30 pieces of silver was blood money. If you know what blood money is, that's an admission that Jesus was unjustly condemned. It was money paid to bribe a man into execution. And so you've got Judas, you've got the chief priests, and then in our text this morning, in verse 19, you even have the testimony of an unnamed wife of a Gentile governor testifying that Jesus was just, that he was innocent. And by the way, that's a conclusion she came to while she was unconscious. Even unconscious people know how Christ is innocent. And then lastly here, this brutal Jew-hating terrorist in verse 23 is going, come on. What did he do? He didn't do nothing. This guy's innocent. And so, has Matthew done his job? Jesus is innocent. You get that, right? Judas agrees. High priests agree. Pilate agrees. Pilate's wife agrees. People we know, people we don't know, evil people, wicked people, brutal people, they all know Jesus is innocent. Everybody knows Jesus is innocent. Everybody. That includes you. So you can say what you want about Jesus. I'm telling you, everybody knows Jesus. Everybody knows Jesus, and everybody knows he's innocent. Everybody knows God exists, and everybody knows God is right. Do you understand that? There's no such thing as an atheist. Bible backs this up. People know that there's a God. They know that they'll answer to God. That's why they clamor so desperately for a way out, because they know they're accountable. That's the whole reason for the madness that we see out there. People hating Christianity. That's why people put swords to their throats and guns to their heads. That's why they've been martyring them ever since the beginning. They hate this because they know it's true, and they would murder God all over again if they could, because they want to just eliminate him from their conscience. Everybody knows that there is a God, and everybody knows that he's innocent. Everybody knows they're the guilty party, not Jesus. And what do we do with that information? Oh, just about anything we can to get ourselves off the hook, but nothing works. Again, big bucket of paint, us in a corner. Pilate is making his way into that proverbial corner. In verse 23, Pilate asks what evil he's done. Nobody has an answer. They just insist that he die. When Pilate saw that he couldn't prevail at all, verse 24, at all, but rather that a tumult was rising. That's a riot. Oh, no. Right? This is the very thing he didn't want to happen. Great. You know, it's funny. This is the very thing that the Jews didn't want to happen. You remember back when they said, hey, we got to find a way to arrest Jesus, but don't do it, you know, when everybody's around because we don't want a riot. They were trying to avoid a riot. And now the very riot they were hoping to avoid is the one they're trying to instigate. Get everybody worked up. Start throwing dirt. Throw some dirt. Hey, crucify him. We don't want him around. Get nasty. Get wild. Get unruly. Because that'll paint Pilate into the corner. See, God is going to find a way to force you to choose who you're going to surrender your life to, what you're going to surrender your life to, if you're going to finally admit that Jesus is right and true and that you are wrong. Everybody will be faced with that decision one day. So Pilate realizes he can't prevail. There's going to be a riot. So he took water and washed his hands. This is symbolic. He's trying to symbolically demonstrate before a number of witnesses here that the guilt isn't his. So he washed his hands before the multitude saying, I'm innocent. I didn't do this. You guys wanted it, not me. I'm innocent of the blood of this just person. You see to it. You know what the problem with that is? It takes more than water to wash the blood of Christ off of your hands. That's not how you get rid of it. You get rid of it by surrendering yourself to him, confessing your sin, and letting him wash the blood off of you. Pilate is making a big mistake here, thinking that a little bit of a religious ritual, perhaps even borrowing from Jewish traditions, wash my hands and just kind of, you know, oh, there we go. It says in their own law books in Deuteronomy that if you do this, then you're not in trouble. And Pilate's going, I'm not in trouble. You know, God sees. I'm washing my hands in your pure water, so we're good. But it doesn't work like that. Nevertheless, verse 25, all the people answered and said, no problem. His blood be on us then. We'll take it. No problem. And our kids. Like we care. So they're saying, we'll accept the curse, if there is one. We'll accept the, no problem. Just kill him. So Pilate released Barabbas to them. And when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. He made up his mind. Everyone will. Was it the right decision? No. No, not for Pilate. Pilate shouldn't have done that. Uh-oh, not good. You can actually read history books and find out that Pilate was eventually, he did lose his job anyway. He lost his job. He was banished to a distant region, and he killed himself out there. So history tells us that he committed suicide. So let's just put it this way. Rejecting Jesus and pushing him away when you know that he's knocking on your door, that doesn't promote mental health. Okay? That doesn't promote mental health in a person. It's very unhealthy. You would say it's mentally ill. And it will lead to all kinds of symptoms. You will become symptomatic if you live your life like that. And you won't get better, not by yourself. This is something that your immune system can't take care of. You need to be cleansed. You need to be healed of your rejection of Christ. He's trying to wash his hands, keep clean, germ-free, little sanitizer. Not me. This is on you. He never asked for the responsibility of making that kind of a decision. But we don't either, do we? None of us ever asked for this. We were born. We came into this world. Nobody asked our permission. Your mom and your dad just did it. And here you are. And now you're faced with a decision. You're an adult now. Pilate never asked for this responsibility, and neither do we. But it's a decision that you'll make. It's a critical decision about Christ that each of us is faced with. Oh, how we wish we could avoid the decision. Some of us trying everything we can to postpone making that decision, like Pilate did. But the Bible that we're all familiar with, the Bible that probably most of you have in your lap, if not on your phone, your Bible says, you need to pick. Choose. Today, who you're going to serve. And if it's unappealing for you to serve Jesus Christ, then decide who it'll be. Do you want Jesus the Christ? Or do you want Jesus Barabbas? Some other version of Jesus. There's plenty. Our culture has been pumping out false Jesus Christs since the church began in the first century. There's lots of false Jesuses for you. And perhaps you've been following a false Jesus, one that you kind of patched together in your own mind. I like this attribute. I would like this attribute. And that's the kinds of things I would like in a Jesus if I'm going to follow him. And